the figures which I've been talking about so far really are figures from history who lived in the time before there was such a thing as psychology. We're now moving up towards the start of psychology as an independent discipline. With Galton, you see just the first steps towards modern psychology. And with Wundt, you see actually someone who was a professor of psychology, founded a department of psychology. Now, you might think, as I get towards the more modern figures, I will become even more enthusiastic. But actually, today's lectures, particularly the first one, creates a problem for me. So far, I've picked and chosen figures who I really like. I like their writing. Locke, I may find some of his writing unsatisfactory, but I like the man. I like his writing. Shaftesbury as well, despite his aristocratic snobbery. Reed, Darwin, what a wonderful person. And I hope I've communicated my enthusiasm to him. But now, with Galton, my tone will change. I'm dealing with someone not only I don't enthuse about, there's much about Galton which repels me. And just as I have been enthusiastic for some of the figures I've spoken about up to now, I will not hide my repulsion for Galton as I speak to you. And I will justify it in this way. Do you really want me to go through each figure saying, blah, 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 this person did this, he had this good point, this bad point, as if I had no views and I was just a machine giving out information? Now, if I'm going to be enthusiastic about some people, I must also show my dislike of others. I must thus justify my dislike. It's no good me saying, oh, I don't like Galton. Give me a heebie-jeebies. I've got to give reasons. And I hope I've given reasons why I respect Darwin and Locke. But also, and this is a very, very, very important point for you all, the fact I may have certain likings, certain dislikings, certain prejudices, certain feelings, does not mean that you have to copy them. I'm providing a view on these figures, but at all times I say, you've got to read them yourself. You've got to make up your own minds. Do not think that if you disagree with me, you will suffer in the exams. If it turns out you like Galton, you dislike Locke, or whatever, it doesn't matter. In fact, I would rather that than you ignore them. Oh. So we'll come on to Galton, but just as I have to justify my enthusiasms and justify my dislikes, so do you. It's no good you saying, oh, I thought you were unfair to Galton. Full stop. Turn over the page. Next question. You have to say why. Galton, you'll see, he's the first figure we've got who actually lives into the century in which you all were born. And me. And Galton imagined himself to be a Darwinian. And with Galton, you see the start of a Darwinian type of psychology. And Galton, above all, wanted to study differences between individuals, differences between species, differences between types of humans. And he was, in his view, deeply scientific. He wanted to be scientific. And here we have the first person who I've talked about who uses statistics. You all have to study statistics. Galton is the first one I'm talking about who used statistics. And in fact, Galton invented many of the sorts of statistics which you have studied and which you have been taught. So we're coming on to someone who's modern. Modern, scientific, you might think deeply rational, but no. And this is the paradox, and this is one at root of why I repent by Galton. His work was deeply political, for me an unpleasant politics, and deeply racist. Now here is an issue for all of you, because you have grown up in a time where it's assumed that racism is probably a consequence of a lack of education or ignorance. You don't expect educated scientific geniuses to be racist and to be formulating racist theories. But in the Victorian age, that was not true. And so here, in the foundation of modern psychology, you'll see a figure who without doubt was a genius. A disturbing genius, because he was using his ideas on psychology to develop theories which nowadays we would see as undeniably racist. Because in the Victorian age, it was possible to be both scientific and racist, because there was a sort of racist science which was itself deeply political. And the message of Galton is a very disturbing and complex message. Let me go through it. Let's go back to Darwin. And Darwin talked about variation. You can't have evolution, according to Darwin, unless you have variation. With variation, it means some variants are better positioned to adapt and some are less well positioned. And then there's the question, if you talk about variation, how much variation is there with it? Is there within a particular species, within humans? And if, as Darwin said, also some things are inherited in common to humans, what's the relationship between variation and similarity? How much unity is there which draws us all together, and how much diversity? And here we have a question which can't just be answered scientifically. It's also a question of choice. If you're going to be a biological psychologist, an evolutionary psychologist, a Darwinian, and you accept there's both unity and there's variation, then you have a choice. Do you concentrate on the unity, something like Chomsky did? Or do you concentrate on the variation? And we'll see that Galton did that. It's really, you could say this is like the half empty of a half full glass. There isn't a scientific resolution of a problem of should you concentrate on the emptiness of a glass or the fullness of a glass. It could also reflect your own predisposition. The optimists look at the half full glass, the pessimists at the half empty. And it's the same here, unity and diversity. Darwin, and I think because of his temperament, often stressed the unity of human beings. I'm going to give some quotes later on. Talked about common emotions across the human species. People's living in very different places, very different styles of life. Having common emotions, smiling, laughing, crying in the same ways. And in The Descent of Man, where he talks about the different, what he called races of man, and that was common in the Victorian age to use the concept of race, which now no biologist these days accepts as a scientific concept. But Darwin said, well, the differences are small. Modern geneticists would bear him out. Galton claimed to be Darwinian. The publication of The Origin of Species changed Galton, changed his thinking. Here was a wonderful book that suddenly opened up all possibilities to him. And he thought that humans, this is the problem. He wasn't interested in mollusks and vegetable mould as Darwin was. Darwin wrote a whole book about vegetable mould. Darwin was interested in all different bits of nature. Galton, above all, it was humans. This notion of the survival of the fittest struck a chord in Galton. It meant there are some humans are better adapted and should survive, and some humans not so well adapted and shouldn't procreate and shouldn't survive. And throughout his thinking about biology, Galton stressed the variation, stressed the differences between humans within one nation, one race, and stress differences between races. And when I use the term race here, I am following Galton's uses. I am not using it as an analytic term myself, because as I say, it's a social concept, it's not a biological concept. And throughout his adult life, Galton feared that Darwin had shown something fundamental about the human species and was showing, and this fundamental insight, should be taken as a warning that somehow we are losing as human beings the struggle for existence, the battle for survival. Now, let me say a few words about Bob Galton. Very much a Victorian fellow. Look at his dates. He was born just 15 years before Queen Victoria came to the throne. He lived throughout the 19th century and just went into the 20th century as an old man. Very upright person. He's very Victorian in his thinking. Victorian English, above all. His background was his parents were his father was a banker, but the families had made money in industry. Not an aristocrat, but that new successful middle class, because the Victorian age for the British was an age of empire, where British troops, were British colonialists, went throughout Africa, went to North America, yes, in Canada, throughout the world, annexing territories, ruling over indigenous peoples, commanding. And Galton came from the imperial class. He actually was Darwin's cousin, first cousin. They were related. They knew each other as children. And just as Darwin's background was industrial and middle class and scientific, the Wedgwoods, the science of pottery, so was Galton's. But just because people have similar backgrounds, it doesn't mean they have the same personality or the same views. It seems as children, Darwin and Galton were very different. Darwin, as I said last week, his parents worried about him. He never seemed to be studying properly. They worried that maybe he wasn't that bright or that academic. He was always wandering about in the countryside and playing with his dogs and whatever. Galton was I've read several biographies of him, and from a young child, he seems to have been a most insufferable prig. He was a child prodigy. And when his parents had visitors coming round, they would bring out the young Galton, the young Francis, to perform for the visitors, to recite mathematical formulae or to show off his wonderful little childish intellect. And Galton loved that, showing off in front of the adults. And there is no doubt that he grew up with a very active brain, a polymath. Do you know what polymath is? It means he has talents and abilities across disciplines, across a whole wide range of things. His inventions are incredible. He was a map maker, and he devised certain ways of recording geological and geographical characters in maps. He was a meteorologist, apparently, anti-cyclones. He worked out how they operate. He combined the two. He devised the modern weather map, with its barometers and isobars and isotherms, not barometers. Fingerprints. He didn't invent the fingerprint, but he invented a way of classifying fingerprints so they could be used to identify criminals. You know, it'd be known that everyone's fingerprint was different, and if the police could work out, reproduce a fingerprint, and then they would want to check it with their data of criminals' fingerprints, well, that would be so difficult to go through one by one. It was Galton who solved the problem of how you should classify fingerprints, so you can get one and then look it up in the data bank quite easily. All sorts of inventions. He invented a high-powered, very high-pitched whistle so he could study animal reactions, so he could whistle on his whistle and see if dogs or sheep or cows responded and how they responded. And not only did he invent this whistle, he devised a way of putting it in his cane, like a Victorian figure. He had a big walking cane, and he put this high-powered whistle in the top so he could just pick it up and whistle and then watch things. There's no doubt he had an active, creative mind. He never really worked in university, except he did do some lectures when he was a very old man at London University. But it was unlike all of us who teach you. We all have to earn our living by lecturing to you. He had no need for that. He had independent means. He didn't need to give lectures to earn his living. And he could just write and do his research as he wanted. As a young man, he joined the Imperial Enterprise in Southwest Africa. He was an explorer in the lands in West Africa, which the British imperialists, wasn't yet the British Empire officially, were annexing and ruling over. And this is where he learned to be a map maker, because the British, any colonial power, when it takes over a territory, will want to map it, will want to say what it is it owns. And mapping was a way actually of possessing. And he was a colonial administrator. And when he returned to Britain, he wrote a number of best-selling books about his experiences. They were actually like travel books about my experiences in West Africa, and then books about if English gentlemen and ladies want to travel to Africa, and he said they should and see the sights, this is what they need to carry: huge trunks full of sun hats and pith helmets and advice about how to give orders to the natives. Here, what may be amusing tips about how to avoid the flies, or whether what hats to wear to keep out the sun. And it's here how you should speak to the natives. That even today, it's shocking to read what Gulton had to say. Deep racism comes out on the page. How to give orders. How to flog people if they don't obey you. And a strong sense that the people you give orders to, they were inferiors. And don't forget, it's not just race here, because he would also talk about the British working class in the same way, the Irish. A sense of a hierarchy in the world, with the British middle class and upper classes up the top, going down and down and down against the people they should be commanding. The tone of his writing, and I think his personality, very different. Darwin in The Descent of Man, he talks about race and racial differences. He was a European, a white European. He was considering the other peoples of the world, people who lived and often looked very different. But here's a passage from The Descent of Man. I was incessantly struck while living with the Fuegians. They were the South Americans from the tip of South America I talked about last week, on board the Beagle, with the many little traits of character showing how similar their minds were to ours. And so it was with a full-blooded Negro with whom I happened once to be intimate. Now, two things about that tone of phrase. When Darwin was writing, the term Negro did not have the associations which it has now, which it really became a negative word, a word which really shouldn't be used in the last quarter of the 20th century. Even in the 1950s, 1960s, so black Americans would be talking about themselves as Negroes. So there was nothing insulting at that time in the word, in the use of the word. But it's a word not to be used now, and it's a word which is more insulting than analytic. And when he said happened to be intimate, the word intimate doesn't have the evocation which it may have on Twitter or Facebook. It means he was a close friend, and he is talking about his lecturer on anatomy at Edinburgh University. So here was a European mixed with other people's, and mixed with an ease and a familiarity with other people, not looking to command and to flock. And as he did so, he noticed the commonality of humans. And he also noticed the story of Fuegians going back to Tierra del Fuego, throwing off their European clothes. And Galton's tone, when he talks of other peoples, is so different. There's a harsh bigotry, a sense of judgment, a sense of superiority, as if he's always arranging people in a hierarchy, and a sense of difference. He's not looking for the commonalities, always looking for the differences. Especially what he thought were biological differences. But Galton was struck by the origin of species. I mean, he really admired Darwin. Darwin was his hero. And as I mentioned, the origin of species didn't discuss humans. Stop short, because Darwin was a bit reticent about that. He knew it would upset people. But for Galton, how to apply these great ideas, these scientific ideas, to humans. And three things struck Galton and were constant throughout his psychological writings. Right from when he first started writing on these psychological things in his late 30s, right to the death of the old man. One is the importance of the inheritance of psychological characteristics. What makes us as we are is not learnt, it's inherited. Second, Darwin had talked about variations. People are different, especially biological variation. And Galton said, well, if there are variations, then it's important we work out how to measure these variations. It's no good just talking about the variations. We've got to learn to measure them. We've got to devise techniques for measurement. And Galton was a mathematical genius. There's no two ways about it. He thought in mathematical terms. Constantly doing sums in his head. And there was something else. Darwin had talked about natural selection. And some of his ideas on natural selection, as I talked about last time, were based upon talking to animal breeders and plant breeders, based on non-natural selection. And Galton wanted to take the ideas of natural selection and go back to artificial selection, because he said the inheritance of good psychological properties, good physical properties, is so important for humans that it cannot just be left to chance, to natural selection. We must take command of our own destiny by controlling our own breeding. By improving on natural selection to make certain the strongest, the most adapt humans survive and breed. Now, his early psychological publications were about talent and success. He wanted to say that talent, and particularly intellectual talent is inherited, and if it's inherited, you'll find that it runs in families. There are two books about it, one called Hereditary Genius, and the other English Men of Science. And basically, his methodology was, he used reference books to begin with to look up the biographies of eminent men. Women he ignored, and particularly Englishmen, because of all the different nations, the Englishman, the Gorton, was the best sort of gentleman. And he wanted to see how many eminent men had eminent relatives. His idea was it was a crude genetic thing, but his genetics, which make, well, he didn't use genetics, his biological inheritance. This is still before the discovery of genes. It's biological inheritance which produces great talent. And so biological talent will run in families, so if you take a great person, they are likely to have great relatives. Oh, who could he have been thinking about? Could he have been thinking about the great Darwin, who, if he was so great, his family must have greatness in it, and his cousin must be great. Oh, perish for thought. And he sent questionnaires to members of the Royal Society, asking them about their own lives. Members of the Royal Society, which is the scientific society, the great scientific society of England or Britain. Now, when I say he sent questionnaires, you've probably all just written that down. You probably haven't paused for a moment, as if that's, you know, you're going to send out questionnaires for your project, and you've probably spent the 30 years who've sent out questionnaires. I never mentioned that Galton invented the questionnaire. To do this, he invented the questionnaire. Not quite like a modern questionnaire, but the idea of sending out to a large sample of people standard letter asking certain questions, standard questions. And before he did this, people said to him, "Oh, Francis, what are you doing? They'll never reply. Do you?" And he said, "Oh, yes, I do." And he solidly was right. And his first real psychology publication wasn't one of those books. It was in a popular magazine, actually, which was addressed as much to English ladies as gentlemen, called Macmillan's Magazine. A general interest magazine, not a specialist magazine. Would anyone like to hazard a guess why he published his first psychological publication in a magazine like that, rather than in a specialist journal? The answer is quite simple. There weren't no specialist journals really then. If we're talking about a time before the institution of psychology as a subject, it means if there were no psychologists, there were no journals of psychology. And in this article, Galton publishes data about eminent men and their eminent relatives. And what is striking, in my view, about this first article in psychology is the confidence with which Galton wrote. He wasn't setting up a hypothesis and saying, "Oh, here is a question, here is a problem, and we need to study it with lots of different programs of research." It was as if he was founding science and finishing it at exactly the same time, because he was saying, this is what happens. But eminent men have eminent relatives, and this proves that eminence is biological or is inherited. And then he makes parallels with dog breeding and cattle breeding, saying, if you want to have a good milking cow, you mate the father of a good milking cow with the mother of a good milking cow, and you'll get better milkers. And the same dogs, if you want a good hunting dog or a fast-running greyhound, you mate them accordingly. And having, to his own satisfaction, shown that inheritance is at the root of eminence and scientific talent, he then raises a practical problem for humans. How can we be our own good breeders? How can we encourage the best to breed with each other so that the next generation is of better stock than the present generation? And how can we discourage inferiors from breeding? So, you know what? Dog breeders do that. If you have a dog which actually isn't much good, and you can't sell as a gun dog or as a greyhound, you don't bother to get it to breed. You stop it from breeding. And sometimes you take it out in a field and shoot it. How can humans encourage the best variations to perpetuate? All this in the first article. And then, in this first article as well, very characteristic of Galton, he makes it clear he's not just talking about the best and the inferior within a nation or within a given population. He's also making comparisons between populations, and particularly between the Europeans and particularly the English and others, non-Europeans. And as he does this, as he talks about other groups, what he calls other races, his language moves from talking about differences within a population to imagining that these others are all the same, as if there is no variation. So he writes in terms of the most insulting stereotypes. American Indians, sullen reserve and show little sympathy for each other, as if this encompasses them, as if there isn't the gradations of variation. West Africans, his writings about the West Africans are the most shocking of all, I think. Eminently gregarious, always jabbering, quarrelling, tom-tomming or dancing. This is the sort of remark that you expect to read in the most low-grade pro-fascist publication. You don't expect it to read it in the works of a genius who was founding a new academic discipline. This shows something about the relations between so-called science and culture. Now, there's obvious problems with Galton's work. There's this diving into the preferred option, showing that families tend to have lots of eminent people, could be used as an argument for inheritance. Equally, it can be used as an argument for the effects of the environment. The families provide environments which nurture talent, which encourage education, and so on. But Galton always is going for the biological balance, dismissing the nurture side. Oh, nature nurture. You've all heard this term, nature nurture? Do you know who invented the term nature nurture? Have a guess. Bloody Francis Galton. And then how to define eminence? Maybe he's just concentrating on one form of eminence, which is related to having good contacts, that you can succeed in science if you know someone who works in a university or who has an industrial position, or who can get you a job as a naturalist on the Beagle, or a job in West Africa. And of course, there's the exclusion of women from his data. And the other thing is the subjective basis of his judgments. I've said racial judgments, I'm being kind, it should be racist. Above all, Galton was obsessed with measurement. How to measure things. And it was this obsession which I think has led to his eminence, to his continuing eminence, and his continuing influence on psychology. He became increasingly anxious to show how desirable superior qualities of intellect and bodily strength were related. That those whose brains were so huge that they barely fitted into the normal size head would also be those with strong, good, healthy bodies who could run and lift weights and so on. And to explore this, to prove it, he turned what was previously been a biological concept called co-relation into the statistical concept of correlation. Co-relation meant that two traits or features, biological features, zoological features, would be found together. A bird which might have a big wing might be likely to have a long leg, or a small wing and a small beak, or whatever. And Galton said the same thing will be happening to humans, big brain, strong arms, and so on. But he turned it into a statistical concept. Basically, Galton recognised the importance of the normal curve. In fact, he collected data, and time and time again he said, look, when you get collections of data, you can see that time and time again it always falls out like a curve. If you collect people's heights, there's a midpoint where most people come, and there's a few incredibly short, and there's a few incredibly long, the same with weight, the same with abilities for throwing, the same with anything you look at, you get the normal curve. Now, for instance, would the length of the arm be related to the length of the leg? Well, he said, well, the way to look at this is to calculate different data in one curve, say the arm curve, the distance of each point from the centre, and then calculate for the same, the corresponding leg or arm, the distance from the centre, and combine all these measurements and express them on a scale of 0 to 1, 1 being if exactly the same distance from the centre for the leg and the arm for each measurement of leg and arm occurred, and zeroed if there was no relation at all. And he called the number which you find, the R, the regression. And this is what you would have been taught in correlation. It comes from Galton and wanting to measure human talents and to see whether they were related, whether the healthy body was related to the healthy mind. I will take it for granted that you've been taught the technicalities of how to calculate correlations. And I'm saying where it came from and what he was doing with it and why it is just the same, really, in essence, as we were taught now. And at the root of it lies Galton's perception of the ubiquity of the normal curve, that data seems to aggregate in this way. Okay, any questions so far? Regression, the word he used, was something actually which was that there's a tendency for children to have characteristics which are closer to the mean, the norm, than their parents. So that if a parent on any dimension is an outlier, say one parent is incredibly tall, it's likely their child will be tall, but not as tall as the parent. And things slip back. That's what he meant by regression. And that is what the correlation coefficient, the regression means. But he was always concerned with the practical implication. How can you improve the quality of the race? How can you try and combat this regression? At least at the good end of the spectrum. So the fittest parents breed, and breed even fitter children. And how can you stop the unfittest from breeding? And how can you encourage the fittest to have more and more children? I should add that Galton never had any children himself. One of his biographers comes up with a very scurrilous suggestion that when he was a young man, he may have contracted syphilis in a Moroccan brothel, and so he couldn't breed. That, of course, is just tittle-tattle. And I wouldn't dream of repeating it in front of them. He called his idea for trying to control the breeding of people eugenics. Means good breeding. And when he first started formulating the eugenic idea, which was at the high point of British imperialism, it was considered rather eccentric. The British upper classes were thinking, well, we're doing quite well. We're going out, we're conquering the world, everything seems to be going fine, industry is blooming, railways are being built and so on. We don't need to pay attention to this. But by the end of the century, when Galton was becoming an old man, his ideas started taking root more and more. There was a sense that the nation and European nations were in decline. There was a sense that the poor, the unfit, were breeding and breeding and were having far too many children and were dragging everything down. In the first years of the 20th century, the great imperial powers defeated in South Africa by the Boers, a group of peasant farmers. And with increasing industrialization, become increasing malnutrition. The poor are getting smaller and smaller. The British Army had to drop its height restrictions. Otherwise, it just wouldn't have enough ordinary people being recruited. And for Galton, this was a sign that the wrong people were recruited. He didn't think of it really in terms of just the product of nutrition. I'm sure if I asked all the men in this room, or to come up and stand here, and stand arranged in height, I would make a prediction that you all be taller than me. Men my height don't come that often in your generation. And you could, if you were Galton, you would say, this is a sign that the race is getting better. It's getting taller and taller and fitter, and you stopped people like me from breeding. But of course, actually, it's not that at all. It's diet in early childhood, that you are eating better and being fed better than my generation. Again, you can choose to look for the environmental or genetic factor. But Galton, in the late 19th century, in the 20th, early years of the 20th century, had hit upon a fear. And into this eugenics, set up the eugenic society, and very respectable members joined it, concerned that the British were not breeding properly, that the wrong people were having too many children, and that if the race were weakened, then other races would take over. Galton had a devoted protege, Carl Pearson, who became one of the first professors of psychology at London University. And you see, right at the end of Galton's life, psychology being instituted as a subject. And Galton, if you thought Galton was bad enough, Pearson's writings were even worse. And Pearson, another great statistician. And Pearson was institutionalising Galton's vision of psychology at London University. And in the first half of the 20th century, racist politics became increasingly popular in Europe. This idea that there was a struggle for existence, and somehow, if you just left it to natural selection, the catastrophe was occurring because of advances in medicine. The unfit to survive were surviving, and not only surviving, were breeding. And that what we needed was a politics to control breeding, to breed better, healthier nations. These ideas, which you find in Galton, were really the basic ideas of Marxism and fascism. And there were strong links in the 1930s between the eugenic societies in Britain and the eugenic societies in Nazi Germany. and Hitler in his Mein Kampf used quasi Darwinian language, talking about the survival of the fittest and the German race in decline, and we need to be strong like animals and so on. It's a shameful story. Because it's easy for us at the university to deal with the sort of racism which we can attribute to ignorance and lack of education. The sort of racism which is to be found on the streets today in the early 21st century. But it's much harder to deal with the sort of racism which owes its origins not just to education, but to science. It's for this or pretensions to be inside. And I think this is one reason why we need to be careful about the claims of psychology to be scientific. Because psychology isn't a science like chemistry, zoology. It's a science so called about ourselves. And when we formulate a science about ourselves, at all times there's choices. Like the choice Darwin and Galton faced. Should we concentrate on the unity of human beings or what separates human beings? That is not a decision you can say can be resolved by statistics or by experiments. It's a decision which involves choice. What sort of science of humans do we want? Do we want a harsh science, a science which divides us, a science which may tell some people they're not fit to breed? Or do we want a science which concentrates on our humanity? It's the choice of science and the type of science which matters, as much as the nature of the science itself. Okay, I shall stop there. Any questions? We'll have a 5-minute break and then I'll come on to Wundt. Wilhelm Wundt. Those are his dates. And if you look up in the history of psychology book, you'll find that he's normally talked of as the founder, the proper founder of experimental psychology. I'll be suggesting that it's not quite that simple, but there's a good case for it. He devised experiments in a way which none of the people I've been talking about so far devised experiments, and you could ask, well, why did he do experiments? What's the point of experiments? And for Wundt, the point of experiments was to try to produce a science of experience. Not a science of behaviour, but a science of experience. In this respect, Wundt's experimental psychology was rather different than modern experimental psychology, and all the more interesting for that. Right, I've just given the introduction to Wundt. You haven't actually missed anything of substance. But if you'd come in a minute later, you would have. Now, so far, the different figures I've been talking about have been, even if I haven't called themselves psychologists, have been showing that there could be different types of psychology, with different objects of study, with what they study is different, and different ways of studying what they study, different methodologies. Locke, cognitive processes, have a mind, deals with information, and he claimed to be examining his own mind. You look and see how you think, how you make judgments. Darwin, quite obviously, wasn't looking at his own mind. He was looking at behaviour, looking at what people do, what animals do, what his children did. And in contrast to Locke, he was looking at inherited behaviour. And Galton was looking above all at differences. Individual differences, group differences, differences in inherited characteristics. What methods? Use questionnaires. He measured people. And he was formulating techniques for comparing differences mathematically, using statistics. But there's a big gap in the different methods, types of psychology which I've been talking about. No experiments. Galton is not an experimentalist. Giving questionnaires to, sending letters to members of the Royal Society is not doing an experiment. It's not a laboratory experiment. That we're approaching towards modern psychology slowly. Statistics we're starting to get with Galton. Not the experiments. Experiments we're going to get with Wundt today. Now, I've mentioned that, I shall repeat it, that the traditional histories of psychology, but Wundt has a big pride of place. He's a very serious German with a big beard, as the founder of experimental psychology and the founder of psychology as a separate discipline. For those who consider it important that a science must have its own discipline, must offer its own degrees, then it needs to work out who it should venerate as the person who set it up as an original, as a separate discipline. And always people say, Wundt. Wundt is the man. Now, Wundt was the founder, if there is one, of experimental methods in psychology. But do not imagine that Wundt said everything must be an experiment. Unless you do experiments, this is not a science. We shall see. He didn't take that simple point of view. In fact, Wundt distinguished between two methods, one he called experiment, and the other he called observation. And we'll see that he said, actually, observation can be pretty good for certain things. Now, what is the difference? Observation is really like what Darwin did, what astronomers did. It's when you observe things which are happening. When Darwin watched how animals behaved, he was watching them as they behaved naturally. birds had their courtship patterns. How they attacked, how they defended. And observation is different, according to Wundt, from experimentation. Because in experimentation, you don't observe what is going on. You intervene. You create situations. You may even create differences, two different groups. This to one group and that to another group. You don't just stand back and observe the world as it happens. You intervene into the world and maybe create your own little micro situation. That's the difference between observation and experimentation, according to Wundt, and I think it's a very good distinction. And you might think that psychology is an experimental science. Wundt was the founder of experiments in psychology, so Wundt would be champion experimentation and say, observation, that belongs to pre-science. No, no, he didn't. For him, it was, when should you use experimentation? And when should you use observation? When is experimentation not suitable? He did say that where possible you should use experimentation, but it's not always possible. Okay, let's go further. Wundt's life. Not a very eventful life. He was born in Germany in 1832, and he trained as a doctor and as a physiologist. And when he was a student, this was a great time for physiology in Germany. There were a number of very great German physiologists who were making discoveries about the body. And he was appointed a lecturer at Leipzig, and originally, to begin with, he was lecturing on philosophy. He was interested in the mind. In fact, he seems to have been interested in so many different academic disciplines. But up until then, studying the mind really had been the province of philosophies, that a philosophy of mind was a subdivision of philosophy. But Wundt felt that it was such a complicated business to study the mind that mental life should be considered as a separate object, and there should be a science of studying mental life, and the model was physiology. Just as you have scientists who devote themselves to studying how the body works, so you should have specialists who are devoted to studying how the mind works. And it was too important to leave just to the philosophers. Now, Wundt had an enormous impact. He never stopped working. He was an incredibly serious man. By all accounts, he must have been a crashing bore. It just went on and on and on. 186 doctoral students. I feel ill at the very thought. He wrote umpteen books, umpteen scientific articles. It was calculated that if you set yourself to read his whole output, it would take you about 7 years to do so. And it just went on, wide-ranging. And what the psychologists love, the modern experimentalists, he set up a laboratory, specialist equipment. He set up a journal for publishing the results of the experiments in his laboratory, a psychological journal. You see, if you do all these experiments in your laboratory, and you want to publish each experiment, you can't keep publishing it in something like Macmillan's magazine, which Galton initially published, because the ordinary readers are not interested in that sort of rather dull stuff. You've got to set up your own journals. And of course, the establishment of journals is in one sense a sign that an academic discipline is being formed. But there was more to Wundt than just experiments. He also championed observation as well. Now, what Wundt was doing was trying to answer a question which in the previous century philosophers had said was a challenge. But in the 18th century, the 1700s, many philosophers, German philosophers in particular, had said that a science of experience is not possible. There are a number of reasons why you might not be able to have a science of experience. There's a problem of what's called introspection, which is if you want to analyse experience, it seems that you have to analyse your other. You have to look at your other. But how can you analyse your own experience? Because as you analyse it, you're having the experience of analysing your experience. It's almost as if your experience is always just disappearing. And then there's the problem of observation. It had been known for many years that you couldn't always trust people's observation. This cropped up in the 17th century with astronomers when they made judgments about the size of a star or how much a star had moved. These were people who spent their lives looking at the stars, but sometimes they would judge differently and say, that star seemed to have moved a lot, it seemed to have moved, if you take the whole judgment of the universe, it moved that much, and another would say, no, it moved that much, and you find some observers tended to give big estimates and some gave lesser estimates. Now, if science uses observation, Darwin observed animals, astronomers observed planets, then no doubt there are biases of observation and different people make different judgments about how much they think something is moved. Now here then comes the problem for psychology. Because how does psychology observe observation? How will it study observation? If observation is flawed anyway, then isn't it doubly flawed if both your topic and your method are one and the same thing? One thing to say, I'm going to observe planets, I'm going to observe behaviour, and you have to measure it. How do you observe observation? What your topic is the same as your means. And if there's going to be a science of observation, surely you need a different method than the subject. This is what it was said in the 17th century before, 18th century before Wundt. Why there couldn't be a science of experience. I'll come on to another problem. And you have to often appreciate the problems to appreciate why someone who gets round the problems has actually done something quite interesting and innovative. There was a problem of mathematics and the argument of the great German philosopher who was as equally serious as Wundt, Immanuel Kant. But Kant said, science needs measurement. Dalton would have said, how can Yes, yes, yes. Darwin would have said, yep.
Sorry, do you mind speaking up a tiny bit?
Yep, sure.
Just because of the long hours.
Yeah, no. My voice drops in the second half, I'm afraid. Do you want me to repeat anything?
No.
Okay, science needs measurement. But you cannot measure experience except by time. And therefore, if you can't measure experience except by time, you can't directly compare different experiences. Now, why did he say you can't measure experience except by time? And why can't you measure different experiences? I could try and explain this to you. I could try and explain this using long words. It would be simpler to demonstrate it if I had two volunteers who would come out and just allow me to ask them a couple of questions, and I can demonstrate what it means why you can't measure experience except by time. If there are no volunteers, you're going to get the difficult conceptual explanation. Oh, wonderful, wonderful, come out. Right, thank you. Very simple. Nothing embarrassing or whatever. I want you each to imagine a face. And I'll tell you when to start. And to look at, as it were, the visual image of a face. Okay? And when that visual image, which it will do, disappears, and you no longer see it, even if momentarily, put your hand up. Okay. Start. I should close your eyes. Okay, thank you. Wait. His hand went up before yours. Quite a way. How big was the face you imagined?
Life-size.
Life-size, but the visual image couldn't have been, was it? How big was the face you know, Luke?
It took up quite the whole image, but not the whole time, then it kind of zoomed out.
Now, I can't measure your image to see whether it was bigger than his image, can I? If I said, was it a bright image? I can't measure whether yours was brighter than yours. I've got some descriptions, but they don't lead anywhere. What I can say is that your image faded before your image. I won't ask you who they were images of, because your fading image may be quite embarrassing. But this is what Kant meant, that you can't measure an experience except by time. You can measure when someone says how long it takes for having the experience, like the visual image, but we can't compare your visual image with your visual image in terms of any other property. That's what he meant. And it would have been much more difficult to explain that without the demonstration, so thanks. And you all should thank him. And so, someone like Kant in the 18th century said, a science of experience is really impossible because you cannot compare experiences differently. Wundt's great insight was to say, no, we can set up special situations, which we call experiments, which enable us to compare and to measure sensations and experience. But we can prevent, and this is the basis of it, measurably different stimuli to be heard or to be seen or to be felt, touched or tasted, and ask people, did they notice a difference between these two stimuli? Which is brighter, which is duller, which is louder, which is softer? Wundt was aware that some of the physiologists were doing this. Some of the great physiologists even taught him, like Ernst Weber, who was very interested in the anatomy of touch, sensations of pressure, sensations of heat, sensations of space and where things, objects were. He was interested in what the physiological mechanism is of perceiving a sensation or touch. And then he asked the question, what about how we register pressure? When, at what point, can we perceive the difference between two minutely differing objects which weigh virtually the same? Put, say, one in one hand and one in the other hand. And is there a regularity in the perception of differences? Imagine you put a weight in one hand, which is, say it's 15 grams, a very light weight. Well, let's say 20 grams. And you add another in the other hand, 21 grams. Chances are people say, no, they feel just the same. How many grams do you have to add for people to say, no, this is heavier? And supposing it's 8 grams you have to add. You've got 20 grams here, and you add 8 grams, and people say, yes, this is heavier. Does that mean that the human ability to detect different weights goes up in 8 gram intervals? Or is it that if it's a ratio of 8 to 20, which counts, if you put something which almost double the weight, then you notice a difference? So that if you were holding something which was a whole kilogram and you add 8 grams, would someone detect the weight? That's if human ability went up in 8 gram intervals. Or if it's relative, the ratio of 8 grams to 1 kilogram is much too small. And what Weber found out is the relative differences which are important, not the objective differences. You'll notice 8 grams if it's a 16 gram object, but not if it's a 100 grams. And Weber had all these findings, and then had a mathematical genius called Fechner, Gustav Fechner, who made a formula out of Weber's findings about what we can perceive, when we can perceive differences, and when we can't. We like to think of scientists as very rational people, but Gustav Fechner, another great mathematical genius, was actually a mystic. He was borderline schizophrenic. He believed in all spirits, and a strange man. Science doesn't necessarily mean rational. And Wundt saw, it should be Weber Fechner, not Weber Rechner. Well, that's a mistake. But these findings show that it was possible to formulate laws of sensation, what we can perceive and what we can't, and that sensations have a measurable intensity as well as duration. It was, he said, this sums problem concept. We can only measure in time. We can measure in time, but we can measure in intensity if always we're comparing whether people can feel the difference or not. And we can measure the intensity of different types of sensation. And Wundt said, some senses, human senses, are more sensitive than others. Light sensation, a visual sensation. You change something just by a hundredth, light by a hundredth, and you can notice it. Weight by a hundredth, no, you can't. Pressure has to be almost by a third. Sound by a third. Muscle strength. Proprioceptive muscle senses are much more sensitive. But it's not the details which matter, it's the general point. But here was Wundt saying, you can test people whether they notice the differences between things. And when you do this, you are measuring experience and sensation. And as such, the experimental method provides the basis for a science of introspection or experience. Because what you're saying to the person who's taking part in the experiment is, can you feel that? Put a pen there. Can you feel it? And the other person has to pay attention to their sensations and say, yes, 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 I felt that. Or, no, I didn't feel it. So you pay attention, you introspect, and with the help of the experimenter, you can provide a science of sensation. And this depends on varying systematically the stimuli that affect the physiological system. Weights. You control the stimuli. Here's a quote from Wundt. Modification from without, that's controlling what the person sees or hears or feels, enables us to subject our mental processes to arbitrarily determined conditions over which we, meaning the scientists, have complete control. We control our experiences and then report what we have experienced. And by and large, it's a simple question. Did you notice it? Did you notice any difference? You take down the results. Okay, that's important methodologically. This is at the root of a foundation of psychological experiments. Do you understand why it was important and how it was discovered? I'll go over anything again if you want. There's an important implication from these findings, which go under the heading basically of just noticeable differences, that our sensations do not reflect the world directly or exactly. Remember Locke saying, we just open our eyes and the world floods in and it's passive and it's accurate. But this says, no, it can't be like that. The external world, we can say, is continuous in terms of the qualities which we perceive, like sound, light, weight. It's continuous, but some things, you can make things just get heavier and heavier, lighter and lighter. But what we perceive is found to be relative. We perceive things, one thing relative to another, And we perceive things as discontinuous. Some things heavier than other things, and we can't always perceive the gap between the two. It seems as if it's continuous, but it's not. Do you understand what I'm saying? I'll go over anything anyone wants. And this actually is the basis of modern cognitive psychology, or much of it. That to make sense of the world, we impose schemata on what, on the world, which physically actually is continuous, but our schemata divide the world up into different things, heavy objects, light objects. Loud sounds, soft sounds. And as I talked about last year, and I won't go over this, is the basis often when it comes to dividing human beings into different social groups, continuities of skin colour, for example, or of height, or whatever, or personal characteristics, that this can be seen as more discontinuous than it is. Because there's something about us which judges things in relation to other things. That's why it's relative differences we perceive, not absolute ones. And we think we're perceiving differences between things which are just noticeably heavier or lighter than they are, but they're not. There's a whole lot of objects we can't perceive. We slip by. Okay, it was these psychophysical experiments which were the first ones, and it convinced Wundt that you could have a science of experience. He did this at Leipzig. But there are whole lots of other experiments. I mean, he just went on and on and on, devising new equipment and building new studies, getting new doctoral students who ran new programs. How many things can be perceived at one time? Flash lots of things on the screen. How many things can you attend to at one instant? Wundt's experiment said about four. Flash on lots of numbers on at one for just an instant, and you ask me, but how many did you see? Which ones did you see? Later psychologists were saying probably around seven, but it's again the similar sort of experiment. And one big controversy in Wundt's time. Can one think without sensation? Do you need a sensation to think? If you're thinking, must you feel it? Must you have a visual image? And there was a controversy between different labs. Some say, oh yes, all the people we asked report there's a sensation. Others said, all the people we asked when you're thinking, they say, no, I just thought, I didn't perceive it. And here, and then it comes back to the problem, how do you resolve this? Because your sensations are locked in your brain. There was one set of experiments which Wundt conducted, which pointed the way to a very, very different sort of psychology. These were experiments back in reaction times. Wundt asked the question of how long does it take for the physiological system of sensation and the brain to process information. So if you show people something and they have to determine, is this a male or a female? Is this a red playing card or a black playing card? You just show it and they have to press a button as soon as they see it and press the right one of two buttons, how long does it take? And will it take longer if the judgment is more complicated? Is this a noun or is it an adjective? And what one found is, for more complicated the stimulus, the longer the reaction. And he thought he was timing just the processes, the physiological processes. But the method was saying, actually, you can omit the experience. You don't have to ask people their experiences. You just show something and get them to behave, to react. And the method was saying, well, you can use this for a psychology of behaviour. Not necessarily all the time asking, what did it feel like? Did you see this? What's this? Did this feel the same or feel different? Do you understand why this method is different from the method of which I had before with our two volunteers? You know, think of something. There I was asking about what it felt like. But if you just get people to react as quickly as possible, you're not asking them about their experience. The experience doesn't matter. You're concentrating on how they behave. So the experiments were also providing the means for a different sort of psychology. Not particularly one he was interested in. Do you understand that difference? Does anyone want me to go over it? Now, there's a theoretical problem. One sort of experiment seemed to be very atomistic. It's seeking tiny bits and pieces of thinking, and indeed in the reaction time experiment, of reacting. Sorry, I can tell my voice is dropping. I'm sorry. And then you can ask the question, when I asked my two volunteers about the faith they were imagining, was I getting to something basic in human psychology, so that when you recognise a face, when you think about someone you met yesterday, is it the same as what you were doing there? And when Wundt puts an object in the palm of someone's hand, is that just like how we feel our way about the world? And you would think that Wundt, who spent all his time in these tiny little experiments, would defend them and say, yes, this is the essence of the mind. Here we're getting to the bedrock of psychology. These are the basic building blocks on which complicated mental apparatus, mental processes operate. He said, no. But Wundt was quite incredible. He often criticised himself, sometimes without even realising it. He said, no. We also are capable of very complicated mental activities. We can think in complicated ways. We do more than passively perceive or react or sense. We think about problems. We grasp things. We make decisions. We put things together. We synthesize. And we consciously and actively think. And what Wundt called not perception, but apperception. We have complicated thoughts. And Wundt said, you cannot study these complicated thoughts in the same way as you study sensations. And that often you can't even use experiments to look at these complicated thoughts. To do this, we need observation, and we also need to observe how we act in life. Remember when I was talking about Reed, I mentioned J.J. Gibson, who said most experiments on perception, they're artificial. They're studying what people don't do usually. They're holding the face still and getting shining lights in the eyes. And actually, when we perceive a world, we're doing so much more. We're going around and testing the world, we're moving our heads, we're trying to get all sorts of information. And to understand real perception, you need to observe what we do. Thought would have said, yes, yes. The experiments only tell us so far. Tell us a bit about little things. And this raises the fundamental question about the relation between the study of social psychology, the study of social behaviour, how we exist in society, how we relate to other peoples, and the study of individual experience. The laboratory studies seem to be revealing universal laws about individual processes, how an individual might process experiences of touch or sight. The bigger thoughts, whether we believe in God, whether we have ambitions, what are our ambitions, what we think people should do, how we should behave, these are not affected by shining a light in someone's eyes or placing a tiny feather-like weight in their hand. These are affected by culture, which Wundt called folk culture. A folk culture, he said, showed profound cultural differences between people. And these cultural elements, the myths, the beliefs, the customs, you can't get at by experiments. The experiments only tell you about individual differences, not about cultural differences. Actually, if one believes, it's the same with history. There were four important stages to cultural development. First of all, we were primitive tribes, just all existing and trying to gather food. Then we develop religions and become very religious and mystical in our thinking. Then it's the age of the great political heroes, and we organise ourselves into societies which fight each other. And then he thought we were moving into a fourth stage of a modern rational human being. And he said each age has its different ways of approaching problems, its different sorts of experiences, and you can't study historical development, the historical development of the mind, by experiment. And he genuinely believed that experimental psychology should not be, social psychology, folk psychology, should not be experimental. It needs observation to answer the bigger questions. And the experimental methods were for individual, not social psychology. And it was for individual psychology which was universal. Because he believed that the findings from the experiments would be true about all humans. All humans would find sight more sensitive than weight. Well, I say obviously not people who have visual deficiencies, but whatever stage of development or society, whatever your upbringing, it would be the same. But for cultural differences, you needed a different sort of psychology. Now, why I mention this is because Wundt is often claimed to be the founder of experiments in psychology, and often psychologists say psychology is an experimental science and should be. But the great founder of experimental psychology also said, no, it can't be and shouldn't be completely experimental. There are certain questions you can't answer experimentally. Okay, I shall stop there now. Any questions? No? Okay, I shall see you next week when it is when I shall go back to having two favourites of mine, William James and Sigmund Freud.